Hello and welcome to Nothing Ventured with me, Ari Shah. Today in the studio with me, I had Asif Ahmed. Asif is a partner and head of early stage tech and high growth at Cooper Parry. In today's episode, we talked about focusing on what founders need rather than what founders want.
I suppose it's credit to Cooper Parry for having the sort of foresight and vision to allow us to do this, is that we have the staying power to be able to focus on what we know founders need as opposed to what founders want.
Is there such a thing as founder advisor fit?
I've always been a bit big advocate of founder advisor fit, a bit like people see product market fit and others.
R&D is a term from legislation, not from the dictionary, founders beware, segregating the business from the founder, and are we witnessing the rise of the solopreneur? Let's get straight into it. This is Nothing Ventured with me, Ari Shah, the podcast where I talk to the people behind the stories that make the venture capital ecosystem go round. I've been working with startups from pre-seed to Series C for the last decade, and companies that I've worked with have gone on to realize value and exit, or raise funds in excess of $500 million. I really hope you enjoy the episode, and if you have a guest that you'd love to see me have on, or you have a comment on any of the episodes that I've recorded so far, do reach out to me on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'd love to hear from you. Let's get straight into it. Hello and welcome to Nothing Ventured with me, Ari Shah. Today in the studio with me, I have Asif Ahmed. Asif is a partner and head of early stage tech and high growth at Cooper Parry, an accountancy firm rooted in working with entrepreneurial fast growth businesses across the UK to help them grow, become more tax efficient, and get up to speed with their tech and transform their culture. Prior to joining Cooper Parry, Asif was the founder and managing director of Acclivity Advisors, co-founder of the finance department, a resource for entrepreneurs and their finance teams, and is the author of the best-selling book, The Finance Playbook for Entrepreneurs. Asif, great to have you in the studio.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
No, absolutely my pleasure. Let's get straight into it. Firstly, when people think about startups, and I think you and I both fit into this category as well, The last thing they think about is accounting and finance, right? Often to their own detriment, to be fair. So how does Cooper Parry, and specifically the tech and high growth team, work with founders and startups to get them into a good place with their finance stack?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think what we really have the benefit of, and that's, I suppose it's credit to Cooper Parry for having the sort of foresight and vision to allow us to do this, is that we have the staying power to be able to focus on what we know founders need as opposed to what founders want. Now, that sounds like a strange thing to suggest as a business model, but actually it's almost a bit strange to cater to often early stage founders who've never run businesses before and expect them to know that they know what they need. And so I've always treated my own career and my sort of go-to-market strategy as someone that is going to do the right thing and always present the right option, even in the face of being laughed out of the room. And that used to happen a lot when I was running my own business, to say that, you know, well, Joe Bloggs and Co. will do what you've just suggested for, you know, 30% of the price. Why would you be any different? And we've always focused on actually not services, but value. To the point where actually a lot of people that work with us now will tell you that I almost ridicule the services, to say three quarters of these you don't care about. But there is a value proposition here for this specific vertical.
Yeah, it's really difficult. We find the same thing, I guess, with the CFO business. Like actually explaining that it's not about a productized set of offerings. Yeah. It is the holistic approach of, okay, when you work with a company like Emerge One or a company like Cooper Parry, you're getting more than those discrete services. It's the value add of the having been there, having done it, understanding what founders are going through, understanding what startups are going through, and helping them scale. Whether that's, okay, how do you manage your board more efficiently? How do you work with investors? How do you find investors? But also, well, okay, what do the numbers need to look like to make sure that you are showing your business in the best light? How should they be presented?
Yeah.
All of that stuff. I mean, it's interesting. I was on a founders group chat just earlier where someone was saying to me, okay, well, I do my own stuff on Xero. I've got 20 transactions. When's the right trigger point to move to like an outsourced firm? And I'm like, frankly, like the sooner the better, because unless you know accrual accounting, you're probably not recording your stuff in the right way. If you're not comfortable doing your VAT and payroll, fine. But if something goes wrong, then what then? And you need an accountant, certainly in the UK, to do your stat filings at the end of the year anyway, right? So why take that risk?
Yeah.
Apart from, obviously, yes, it costs some money, but so does everything.
Yeah, no, and I also massively, on the flip side, empathize with a founder's dilemma, right? In that you're arguably probably a little bit defensive at the time because you're so vulnerable about how much is at stake.
And who's trying to take advantage?
Who's trying to take advantage of your situation? How little you know? Is someone going to capitalize on that? And you know, what is the incentive for someone to willingly help you? And so, you know, to dovetail that as well, I always start by talking about what I used to do in my old firm versus what I am able to do now at Cooper Parry. And I used to say, look, the whole reason I'm not running my own firm right now is because I felt incongruent with the fact that I need to be able to present a long-term solution for a founder.
Yeah.
And you know, me selling the idea that a small accounting firm is good for a founder, regardless of how much they've scaled, regardless of what services they may need, is actually doing a disservice to not only you, but then this industry, right? Because I'm putting out the wrong messaging.
Mm.
And I've always, and you know, I know we'll come on to some of this a bit later on, but I've always sort of suggested that ultimately the best companies are self-sufficient, right? And resilient because they learn to do things themselves. So anyone that's trying to teach you or sell you the idea that you can rely on them forever is probably doing it for their own benefit, I would imagine. And so that brings into question then, how do I run the business now? And the only way I run the business now is by saying, look, as an early stage partner, I only really want to be working with you for a couple of years.
2 years, yeah.
And then you raise a Series A or whatever, or you work with, you know, like an Emerge One for a little while, and then you bring all of that stuff in.
Yeah, you have churn baked into your business model.
And why? Because I very transparently have a later stage business that I can then put them in, right? Where they will then do more profitable, frankly, advisory work with us. But unless you can sort of do both, it kind of brings into question what your motivations are.
Yeah.
At least that's how I've felt about this industry.
No, I think I can empathize with that a lot. And I think you and I have talked about this quite often.
Yeah.
You know, having a holistic approach to finance for startups is something that is missing from the ecosystem generally.
Yeah.
I think Cooper Parry have absolutely, and you know, we work with you guys quite closely with a number of clients that we have in common.
Mm-hmm.
And it is really that fact that, you know, we know that, okay, if there is tax or R&D or if there is audit, that, okay, we have a solid solution via Cooper Parry to offer that. And then equally that extends out to, for example, you know, I think with one of our clients, we did a Topco flip to the US. Okay, who do we use in the US?
Yeah.
You gave a recommendation, and we've gone with them because you've worked with them before, et cetera, right?
Yeah.
But the point is, no one is going to really be able to tackle all of that. But as long as there is a firm that is tackling enough of that, I think that gives weight and value to your point to the ecosystem beyond just wearing it to carve out our fees, right?
And I think that, like, you know, I've always been a bit big advocate of founder advisor fit, a bit like people see product market fit and others. You know, obviously it's just it's a coincidence that in my situation, both myself and my colleagues, a lot of us are entrepreneurs or have been entrepreneurs.
Mm.
And so we know what it's like to not be able to pay your PAYE bill, right? As opposed to just in theory, heard about.
Great fun.
What it's like. Yeah. And so, you know, I'm coming from the perspective of sort of rallying for the founder, right? As opposed to sort of saying, here's what the textbook says, you figure out the rest yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think that, you know, and not everyone will have the privilege of having had that situation. But at the same time, you know, it's easy enough as a founder, even if you're not well-versed in technical matters, to be able to say, it's probably worth working with someone that's been in this situation before or has seen this situation a number of times before. What I find really strange is when people literally just optimize for cost and say, you know, that is my North Star in seeking professional help.
Yeah.
Because that feels like it's almost disrespectful to your business.
Well, I mean, ultimately, when you optimize only for cost, you end up paying more in the future anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
Is the reality. And this is, you know, this is the conversation I had recently with someone. You know, again, you could either choose not to use an accounting firm today and save that little bit of cost.
Yeah.
But ultimately, when they come in and have to clean up your numbers,
yeah,
that's going to cost you a whole lot more.
Yeah, it always fascinates me how many companies have spent 20, 30, 40,000 pounds pre-Series A on cleaning up stuff.
Yeah.
Because they worked with
the wrong person,
just the wrong advisor, partner or whatever early on.
Yeah.
But now that the stakes are at the point where they need to raise a round, they're willing to spend anything.
Well, we actually saw this again recently. We had, again, without mentioning names, but we had someone approach us to talk about building out a financial model whilst they're in diligence with a fund.
Right.
Because the fund came back to them and said, but the model that they had that had been built by an in-house CFO that clearly was not really fit for purpose was full of hard-coded numbers, nothing kind of flowed through the model. You couldn't, it wasn't dynamic, so you couldn't change inputs and see different outputs. And it was like, you do need a different model here. And I think, obviously, we then don't go out and say, right, well, it's going to cost you 20 grand because we're doing it, quick and dirty, as it were. But that's the point. It's like, if you don't know what good, well, the problem is if you don't know what good looks like, you end up assuming that people are good because you just inherently trust people to do what they say that they can do. And then sadly, that can actually really hurt you in the future. So I've got a lot of time for that that sort of model. One of the big issues that a lot of companies are seeing right now is the pushback on R&D relief from HMRC. And I know you kind of sit on some panels and so on, but can we just spend a minute and not necessarily more than a minute talking about what's going on here and how founders and finance teams need to be approaching this, since the changes that have been in place for the last year or so really seem to have come down quite heavily. I mean, I think, I don't know if you work with them, but certainly one of our clients, really clever. I can't remember now if you are.
I know
all them for sure. Yeah. But they put out some press in the FT about, how they struggle. And again, anecdotally, we've heard with my own business, I was not able to recover R&D. So take me through kind of what's going on.
So, I think it's a sort of tale of two cities, a little bit, because as you said, I do have slight perspective on this with some of the things that I do with HMRC and the Treasury more widely, but I think that the overall change that has come into play is that HMRC has obviously realized that the way that this scheme has been administered in the past is wholly inefficient and incorrect, frankly, and there's been a lot of abuse that needed to be clamped down upon much earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Now part of that, I think that part of that blame sits with HMRC. Because frankly, it wasn't adequately resourced to be able to stop this abuse in the first place. In some ways, I empathize with the fact that the only option they have now is to over-index on the amount of attention they're paying on it, and therefore resource it so heavily that actually the person in the middle, who is the average founder on the street who's either made a claim or is making a claim, gets crushed.
Mm.
Right? And what does crushed mean? Crushed means that if you had been filing incorrect claims, and incorrect, by the way, by the definition of the legislation, right? And so it's not incorrect because, what you were doing wasn't cool or innovative. But I think that the fundamental failing on a part of this whole scheme is using the word R&D, right? Because R&D, you and I and most people and the average person on the street would consider it to be a definition by the English dictionary, right?
We know what research looks like, we know what development looks like. It's
the
that.
Number of conversations that I've had, and I'm sure my colleagues in the R&D department have had, around how is it possible I'm not doing R&D? All right, it's just like, well, it is, because R&D is a legislation, it's not a dictionary definition.
Yeah.
And I think that was the fundamental failing of everybody, frankly, of the advisor community, for those that were just bandying around contingent fees or success fees or fees for successful claims. And, all of this sort of language that we've later realized just wasn't true, right?
Yep.
There's no such thing as a successful claim. And people thought money coming into the bank meant, wow, what an amazing platform. They only charged me whatever it is, 7%, and I've got the money in the bank. All of that sort of come home to roost now a little bit. Not least there being a massive backdrop of tax holes in the economy, and therefore HMRC needing to find quick ways.
And post-COVID, a huge amount
and,
of...
all of that sort of thing. And so I think most holistically, that is what people need to be aware of, is that there was an under-resourcing and now there's an over-indexing.
Mm.
And unfortunately, if you are a founder that was reliant upon an advisor that turned out to be a little bit unscrupulous, then you're going to find yourself on the short end of that situation.
Because they can go after previous claims, essentially,
yeah,
right?
They can, so. If they essentially determine that you did not have any R&D in accordance with the R&D legislation, then all of your claims can then be retracted
into perpetuity, as in like so there is no cutoff statute
correct
of limitation,
yeah, because the because the fundamental premise was incorrect, right?
Right,
and so, you know, from that perspective, there's a lot of pain and a lot of blood on the streets right now, and there's going to continue to be. There are then iterations of the legislation that have changed. Also, some rates have changed, some schemes have merged, and, you know, that's kind of stuff that people expect to happen.
Although the rate cut was quite significant.
It was quite significant, yeah. And I think that, you know, at the moment, what has been quite painful is that when you were, like us, a bit of an old school R&D team, which is bums on seats, scientists, tax advisors wanting to do a proper job, you really looked quite unfashionable when you were being put up against platforms that were saying fixed fee, this is the price, upload your docs, you get your money. And unfortunately now we're seeing a lot of those founders now, but with documents saying that we're under inquiry.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I've got nothing but sympathy because, you know, there are some eye-watering amounts of money being asked for to be returned. And, you know, some of them are going to be, some of those numbers are going to be existential for some businesses.
Yeah. And not only existential for those past claims, but even for current claims.
Yeah.
You know, there is a real question. I think the thing that has got me is, you know, there are stories of companies where I know that there is actual research and development being done, which are being, you know, told, no, this is not R&D under our rules because someone on a computer somewhere has Googled, you know, does this product exist somewhere else?
Yeah.
And basically said, well, no, you're not actually doing something valuable, and which is sad.
I think eventually the market will shake down and we will reach an equilibrium that I think everybody is happy with. We're just not anywhere near there yet.
Yeah.
I think there's still too much confusion around what is R&D, what is not R&D, as you said. There's still a lot of confusion around, is this still lucrative?
Mm.
Is it not lucrative? Is it still something that's a priority for, you know, UK PLC?
Mm.
Because that dovetails into so many other conversations as well, right?
Mm.
And eventually, I think there will come a time where both the Treasury and the startup community will effectively reach a happy medium to say, okay, this is what we believe now this to be. The problem is we're in a massive shakedown right now.
Yeah. Interestingly, like from my perspective, I just tell clients don't rely on R&D.
It's probably not a bad thing to advise, yeah.
And essentially, if in your financial cash planning, you know, you are looking for R&D to cover a hole, don't.
Don't, yeah. Right. Because even if you can rely on the money, you can't rely on the timing.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's as good as not being able to have the money, right?
And presumably, even if a claim is approved and you get cash in bank, in a year's time, someone else could look at that claim and say, well, actually, you know, that I think is the thing. Founders, we love you. Keep doing R&D. But at the end of the day, like if you're in the UK and you're reliant on that cash, you need to figure out another plan, I guess, is the upshot of all of that. And yes, it does sound like, you know, this is going to shake out over the next couple of years. And look, I mean, frankly, you know, I went through this with my own business, as you're well aware.
Yeah.
When we actually got down to brass tacks and talked through with our CTO and with a team from Cooper Parry in this particular instance, you know, what was the work that we'd done? Was it actually R&D? Actually, it was really hard to call it R&D in the way that HMRC is looking for that today, because essentially we digitized a spreadsheet. And you know, I'm quite comfortable. I mean, I'm not happy about it, but as you know, but I am quite comfortable and accepting that, okay, you know what? Fair cop. Like that isn't true R&D. You know, I would much rather those tax dollars were flowing to truly, truly innovative businesses that are actually changing fundamentally something within the sort of scientific realm.
Yeah.
That's good to know. Sad, but you know, we are where we are. So without obviously naming names, what are some of the common mistakes that you're seeing early stage ventures making when they're thinking about how to run their finances?
Mm.
And what are some things that they can do to set themselves up properly from day one?
Yeah, again, good question. I think that, you know, a lot of common mistakes stem from, as you alluded to earlier, just trying to do a lot of it yourself. Now, more often than not, that comes with a sort of temporary time bar to say, people will say, okay, I'll run the finances for the first 6 months or until I've raised a round, whatever the case may be, which is fine because when you're just reconciling, you know, Costa receipts or whatever, it generally isn't that complicated and there's quite little margin for error. But then you don't realize the sort of small habits that you get into that then compound over time that then shape actually your entire philosophy on this topic. So, you know, I mean, not least the fact that there are things like VAT, which, you know, need to be done correctly because, again, they have a very cash.
Not just in the UK, but elsewhere as well.
They have a, you know, they have a very real financial and non-financial consequence of getting wrong. I think the other thing that a lot of companies don't always pay a huge amount of attention to is just things like how to set up their company properly.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you do end up in that situation where they'll say, oh, you know, I've created the company with one share, for example, right? And it's, you know, that's not, these are not insurmountable problems, but they're certain.
They take time to sort out.
There are certainly things that then add cost and time to then getting correct.
Mm-hmm.
And then ultimately it boils down to then not just not finding the right partner to help guide you through the process of, okay, what do initial processes look like?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is there, can I leverage a bunch of technology to actually sit in between going whole hog to an advisor and where I am right now? Because as you know, there's so many bits of kit out there right now, which will automate things and standardize things and stop you from making mistakes. And I think a lot of founders are sort of reluctant to take that plunge.
It's also additional cost, and they can be quite complex to set up depending on what they are.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And then I think the main one, which I'm sure a lot of people can probably relate to, is just not fully distinguishing between themselves and the business and just money flowing back and forth between the directors and the company, which...
Yeah.
Again, I sympathize to some extent if you're someone that's, you know, left a job and you don't have, you know, a steady salary coming in and whatever, and then suddenly the business card gets used for your taxis or whatever, you know, whatever. It sounds really trivial at this point, but actually, as a firm or as a team rather, because the way that we work with our clients is optimizing for a diligence event, these things actually are
they
a
matter.
Problem.
Yeah.
They're a problem for us. They're maybe not a problem for the average accounting firm that's not got a diligence lens on because they're not really optimizing for that event. But, you know, it's so frustrating when you get to a Series A diligence event, you've got a super exciting business, and then suddenly there's this like price chip or valuation chip because they can't quantify what tax risk there might be for some of the early behaviors of the founder. And that's why, you know, whenever we talk to founders, we sort of say, okay, if that's what you're optimizing for, we're the right team. But yeah, that sort of, I think that sort of distinction between founder and company is one that is a pervasive in early stage businesses.
Yeah, I mean, the other one that obviously comes to mind, and yeah, I think that founder sort of, you know, founder tax business, is an issue. We've seen it many, many times. But the other one, again, you know, we've been called into businesses where we've had an investor say, well, we're not sure we believe this revenue. Can you have a look?
Oh, gosh,
and like
yeah.
after a day, yeah, yeah. it's like, yeah. yeah, you're right. Like they've been yeah. reporting GMV, essentially yeah. GMV as opposed to revenue. They've yeah. been including the VAT, like all of this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And founders just make the assumption that everything is done on a cash accounting basis,
yeah.
which like fundamentally, if you're non-financial, yeah, of course. Like why else yeah. would you do it any yeah. other way? Like, exactly. I don't understand why doesn't that make
yeah.
sense?
Yeah.
But actually it can have real consequences on your business, on your valuation, yeah. on your existence as a business yeah. for that matter as well.
It's right? always really gut wrenching to see an entrepreneur sort of founder's face when you restate the accounts on a proper revenue basis, as opposed to a GMV basis. Cause like, what? That's I thought the number was much bigger than that, and you're like, well, no, it doesn't quite work like that. But again, yeah, it's typical. And to be honest, like I said, you know, there was a time in 2020, 2021 where, you know, unnamed US VC was effectively telling our client that just report it as GMV, and you know, we're sort of wow. thinking.
Because like, it doesn't matter in the US as much.
And A, doesn't matter so much in the US. B, they don't really, they're only reporting it for the purposes of their IC, so
yeah.
to speak.
Yeah.
They're not necessarily reporting it for US GAAP at
yeah.
that time.
Yeah.
And so then it's like, how much of an idiot are you willing to look like as the advisor in the room when the money people are telling you do GMV, the founder wants to do GMV, but you, the accountant, want to do proper revenue recognition, right? And that's what I was talking about earlier in terms of just having staying power and having the ability to just say, well, this is the right thing to do. I don't really care what your VC is telling you. If that's what's incorrect, that's what's incorrect. And actually, a lot of our work actually is to try and end up being the sort of not so popular person.
Yeah, you got to be the grown up in the room, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I remember, and I think this was like kind of when I was first meeting quite a few of the people that are now at Cooper Parry. So this is yeah. back in 2018-19. Yeah. I actually had the privilege of being able to sit in a business and revise their revenue upwards because
okay,
it was
nice.
Very clear that their risk and rewards. And again, like, this is the thing that most people, founders and others don't, and this is getting very geeky, but yeah. It's just, it is what it is. Most people don't realize that this is all down to contractual obligations and transfer of rights and all of these sort of things, the risk that you're taking on as a business. That's how you define where the revenue sits and the timing of that revenue and all of that sort of stuff. Yeah. And actually what we figured out was, actually in this particular business, a lot of the risk and rewards were with the business, and actually what they were stating as GMV was actually revenue. That had an impact on margins and everything flows through. But it changed the profile of that business. That business went on to exit for nine figures. Sadly, I wasn't in the business at the time. But I mean, you know, these are some of the things that I think founders don't realize, both the positive and the negative externalities that can happen if you're not doing these things in the right way.
So I'm curious, like, from your perspective, how what do those conversations look like inside the business when you're a CFO or a fractional CFO? Or because I know what it's like, because when it comes to the accountants, it's almost like, you know, this is...
Shut up.
You end up...
Do what we're telling you.
Exactly, yeah. But internally, I mean, do you end up having these struggles with founders as well around these conversations?
Oh, yeah, 100%. I mean, like, it depends. It always depends to an extent on how business savvy that founder is. For the most part, like, when we're going into businesses, they know that we know what we're doing. So there is less pushback. But where you have founders that are really kind of, you know, the kind I'm talking about, like the super, super like, you know, we know what we're doing. We're a founder's founder. This is going to be $1 billion business, whether or not it is or not. You know, sort of by the by. But it's sort of my way or the highway. When that sort of stuff is happening, we can get pushback. But again, to your point, we do what is right for the business and equally what is right for the shareholders, right? And it is never right to misstate numbers. I think that is essentially the you know, the view that we take. It can be difficult. And it also, I mean, again, it comes down to often strategically what is right for the business. What is the right way to present it? Also, when you're going out to raise investment, you know, depending on how your business looks structurally, what your business model is, you need to raise from different investors. If you are booking your numbers in not quite the right way, it sends conflicting messages out to those investors down the track. So inside or outside the business, it's, I think, often the same problem. So moving on from that, you obviously get a great bird's eye view of the ecosystem, as well as quite an in-depth kind of understanding of what's going on across multiple business models, finances, after all, the ultimate insider, right? So give me a flavor of what trends you're currently seeing and where you think the ecosystem is heading. And what are you bullish about, and what do you think might start falling out of favor?
So I've got a safe answer to this question. And then I've got my real answer to this question. Okay, I'll start with my answer. So I think that I've got sort of three data points, I think, on the same continuum as far as I can see, which is that at the moment, as I mentioned earlier, everything is AI, right? So we're seeing disruption of everything. So the disruption of we're in the sort of disruption of everything moment right now, because there's a fundamental shift in technology, which is sort of really, really chipped away at a lot of cost structures and a lot of ways of doing things before. And so it's like fundamentally breaking down the way that we live and work, right? And I think that, you know, for the moment, at this point in time, we're seeing businesses on across every vertical being disrupted by it right now, right? So that's not news to anyone. I think where a sort of parallel trend to this, and in some respects, I think it's not a coincidence, is that we're seeing a massive boom in the creator economy right now, right? Now, how are they sort of parallel trends that I think converge to the same place? In that, in my mind, the next big trend is the sort of rise of the solopreneur, right? Because
you can tool yourself up in a completely different way.
The existing cost structures have broken down. The sort of the go-to-market curve is now so short that you can, you know, I'm an accountant, right? I've never coded in my life. However, there is nothing stopping me right now from effectively getting 500 beta users into a Discord channel, me using some low no-code software to build an MVP product of something that I believe in, charging, I don't know, $50, $100 a month or whatever, and I'm already earning more than I would ever hope to earn as a partner at GoodParry, right? So from that perspective, like, it's kind of mind-blowing, right, to think about the fact that's where we're at in terms of technologies. And so in my mind, I think the rise of the solopreneur is really where the next wave comes. Now, where I think that causes some issues is that really does ask some questions of venture capital.
It disrupts the venture capital model, right? Essentially.
Because
right.
at that point in time, really, if you're a solopreneur that wants to do, that wants to be a $1 billion business, I think that's infinitely possible, even as a solopreneur. But it just means that venture capital is like only for the few use cases where that is the use case. Mm. Otherwise, you'll end up in a situation where, you know, there's no reason why everybody couldn't be an entrepreneur in some, mm-hmm. of some description. Mm. That's a little bit out there in my mind, but I just think that there's a lot of things happening right now at the same time. I mean, the creator economy, as you know, you're a creator nowadays, is that...
you can't monetize for love and money, but that's okay.
Yeah, but you say that. I mean, we work with some creators right now who ordinarily should be have no business in the tech and high growth department or being clients of the tech and high growth department. But there are some, you know, there are some creators that we work with right now who my kids tell me who they are. Mm. And just making eye-watering amounts of money with businesses that they're building around their distribution channel, which mm-hmm. is themselves, right?
Yeah.
And you know, they're building apps and they're building businesses and marketplaces and products and all of this sorts of thing. And that's like, you know, I think it gives you a little bit of a sense of where things are going, right? And why is that? It's because actually the barrier to entry now with, you know, no code software and AI effect and, you know, large language models for what it's worth, giving you access to any kind of intelligence that you may not have had before. My bet is on the rise of the solopreneur.
Yeah, I actually don't disagree with that. I also think that that is, to some extent, fueled by the fact that venture capital has had its kind of moment of reckoning. Mm. And you know, have said it several times on the pod. What we're seeing is a lot more investment in actual R&D, and going back to our earlier conversation, in actual R&D heavy businesses, mm-hmm. you know, that are probably not going to commercialize immediately, take 3, 5, 7 years maybe to commercialize deep tech, hardware, medical devices, rocket ships, you know, all of that sort of stuff. That's what's getting funded. Why? Because to your point, everyone can build a software business now.
Yeah.
Like realistically, almost anyone could with a relatively low cost base, get themselves up and running.
Yeah.
And then at the stage where they maybe need to hire people, et cetera, yeah, maybe they might look for a round of financing, but it doesn't necessarily come from VC.
Yeah.
and then they scale from there. I think the other thing is, yeah, I mean, I think the whole community-led aspect of things kind of got blurred in with the Web3 kind of phenomenon, which is still there and it's still around.
Yeah.
But actually, you didn't need Web3 for community, irrespective. So community is still there, still persists.
Yeah.
I don't think that is a particularly controversial take, actually, that you'll see more solopreneurs. I think that's a great outcome. I think the controversial take, if there is one, is where does VC fit into that landscape?
Yeah. And I think that, you know, to expand your point earlier, is that I think VC, as you say, it finds itself only funding businesses that are CapEx heavy. Right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, that is a real use case, right? There is only so many dollars that a solopreneur can throw at a business. And if they are building something that requires heavy CapEx, then actually we kind of revert back to the original
venture capital
of where we should have been with venture capital, right? Yeah. Which is funding things that inadvertently cannot be funded by themselves.
Yeah.
And on the other side of that funding, have a commensurate level of growth and scale.
Yeah.
Right? And that was kind of the original thesis. And then we flirted with all sorts of other things in the middle. And we're kind of, I think, going back to where that was.
Yeah, it's sort of it's the transition from, you know, Andreessen's software's eating the world to now, you know, build stuff, essentially, which is, you know, atoms over bits.
Exactly.
Finally, what is one thing that you have a very contrarian conviction about from any area of life, whether that's work, politics, socially, or at home? What is a hill that you would die on defending?
I've said this to you before, actually. So I'm not sure it's going to be that contrarian for you to hear. But my fundamental belief is that everybody is just yearning to unleash their inner artist, mm-hmm. creative. Mm-hmm. And they just happen to be doing it in their current guise as an accountant or as a CFO or as a lawyer or whatever the case may be. Now, where do I go with that theory? I go with that theory to a place where I think that it helps people think about how they build teams. Mm-hmm. I think it helps people with accepting who they really are in some respects. And when you realize that, actually, I think there's a lot to be gained. I was actually having a conversation with a really good friend of mine who's also a founder, as it happens, around hiring, right? Because he was a little bit dismayed by having made some really important hires that hadn't worked out. And I think that's not going to be uncommon to a lot of founders. Yeah. But and we sort of both collectively reached a point of a sort of really philosophical debate over WhatsApp at like 1:45 in the morning talking about hiring, where we said that you want to be so rigorous with your hiring that you can be comfortable with just letting that person play
mm-hmm.
when they're on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And it resonated so much with me because ultimately I think that's all what we're really yearning to do, which is just to be able to like creatively outlet in whatever field that we're in. So do with that information what you will, but that is the hill that I'm willing to die on, that everyone is just trying to unleash their inner artist and creative.
I love that. I mean, I took a very circuitous route to getting to writing and recording content and doing all the stuff that I do. I know you've obviously written a book, and we didn't really get a chance to speak about that, but, you know, I think, and this is why I talk actually in the book that I'm currently writing, I talk about hire slow, fire fast.
Yeah.
And it's precisely for that reason, because you want people, A, you want to go through a process that is rigorous enough that you know that when you get out the other end, this person can do the work that you want to do. Okay, now, will things potentially fall out of that you weren't expecting? Of course, no process is ideal, or no process is 100% foolproof, rather. But people want to be able to do what gives them meaningful, fulfilling purpose in life, often in what they are good at doing, right? So I don't subscribe to the find your purpose, man, and then just do that. No, do what you're bloody good at, and then actually purpose will probably come from that. But also as a founder, there are arguments, and you see a lot of this on Twitter, no, you must micromanage your team. Yeah, no, you need to be on top of the map. But there's a difference between micromanagement and management, right? Yeah. Micromanagement is literally essentially telling the person what to do and like then managing every step of that process. No, that's wrong. But you need to be on top of the deliverables of that person.
Yeah,
but within the remit, give them the creative opportunity to do what they need to do. No, I really like that. And I would love to see the world moving in that direction, if I'm honest. Asif, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the podcast today. For our audience, where's the best place for them to find you online? You're on LinkedIn, Twitter.
Yeah, all of those places. So if I can help anyone in any way, I'm always infinitely happy to.
Amazing. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much, man. Thank you for having me.